We're excited again for one more Sunstone Symposium. You're at session 123, Truth Telling in Mormonism. We've got two presenters today. Scott Denhalter, longtime friend of Sunstone and an editor of part of the Cornucopia section, is here to talk about truth telling in Mormonism. He's a veteran of the Utah public school system and apparently taught to eighth graders. Wow, I won't read that story. And he works as a screenwriter right now. We've also got Ryan Wimmer here, who recently graduated with a degree in history from the University of Utah. I've seen Ryan up there from time to time and know that he's going to do great things in the historical community and is doing work on Nauvoo polyandry and relationships between the Japanese and Utahns during World War II, which I think will be fascinating. Let's get started. We'll turn the time over to Scott. I do want to mention a couple of things. First of all, please, please, please come to this microphone if you have any questions. We say it every year, and every year somebody yells them out from the audience. I've been threatened with my life. I'll have to interrupt you and, you know, put my fingers in my ears and yell, la, 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 la. Just please, please come up to this. Our tape, the Sunstone tape listening audience is far larger than the audience that comes to the symposium. It's a significant source of revenue for Sunstone, which is a nonprofit organization, of course. So please come up and speak into the microphone if you have questions. Make sure your cell phones are off, all any other kind of noisemakers are off. And please, of course, support the vendors and the booksellers in the Harvest Room. Scott.
In his 2005 treatise on bullshit, Princeton's moral philosopher Harry G. Frankfurt defines and examines a class of human discourse that lies outside the truth-lie dichotomy. To introduce his subject, Frankfurt states the following, and I'm quoting, "One of the most salient features of our culture is that there is so much bullshit. Everyone knows this. Each of us contributes his share. But we tend to take the situation for granted. Most people are rather confident of their ability to recognize bullshit and to avoid being taken in by it. So the phenomenon has not aroused much deliberate concern, nor attracted much sustained inquiry. In consequence, we have no clear understanding of what bullshit is, why there is so much of it, or what functions it serves." While Frankfurt describes this class of discourse within the context of American culture, I intend to describe it within the context of Mormon culture. It is not my intention to argue that there is either a greater or lesser incidence of it in Mormon culture than in the larger matrix of American culture. As Mormonism is, however, a most intimately American religion, it is my belief that Mormon culture participates in this class of discourse to a degree at least similar to that of the greater American culture. It is also not my intention to argue that religious discourses in general displays a greater or lesser incidence of this phenomenon than secular discourse. Now, before I proceed any further, I want to reassure those members of the audience who might be offended by a relentless use of the term bullshit, that I will not ape Frankfurt's usage in this presentation, but will instead refer to my subject euphemistically. In place of the word bullshit, I will use the word kidding. And I will refer to the purveyor of bullshit as a kidder. Of course, these words are not freely and fully interchangeable, but for the purposes of this paper, I will adopt the artifice that any difference between them has more to do with considerations of gentility and other rhetorical parameters than with strictly literal modes of significance. Those of you so inclined may restore my text to its original force and clarity by mentally substituting each instance of kidding and kidder to the appropriate dysphemism showcased so prevalently in Frankfurt's treatise. It is my suspicion that very little work has been done on the subject of kidding. That is within the context of Mormon culture. I have searched the topical guide to the scriptures, the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, Gospel Inc., even Eldon Ricks's combination reference, and I have been unable to discover a single mention of the subject. I believe, therefore, it is possible that I am breaking new ground, and this forces me, at least for the time being, to cobble together a limited representation based upon personal experience alone. Perhaps someday researchers will be able to compile a more exhaustive survey. But let me quickly explain Frankfurt's theory of kidding. Mormon scripture defines truth as the knowledge of things as they are, and things as they were, and things as they are to come. St. Thomas Aquinas defines lying as a statement at variance with the mind. In other words, a liar knows the truth, but he makes a false statement in defense of it. Thus, both the truth teller and the liar know the way things really are and are in some way connected with it. Taking up a position somewhere outside the truth-lie dichotomy, Frankfurt defines kidding as a species of misrepresentation that is short of a lie because it is unconnected with a concern for the truth. The kidder is not concerned with the truth value of what he says. That is why he cannot be regarded as lying, for the kidder does not presume that he knows the truth, and therefore he cannot be deliberately promulgating a proposition that he presumes to be false. His statement is grounded neither in a belief that it is true, nor, as with the lie, in a belief that it is not true. It is this lack of connection with a concern with truth that this indifference to know to how things really are that Frankfurt regards as the essence of kidding. The discussion of a concern with truth must necessarily involve understanding the importance of intention. The truth teller intends to communicate the way things really are, while the liar intends to misrepresent the same. The kidder, on the other hand, is engaged in an altogether different enterprise. I am speaking here of primary motivation. A person who tells the truth may have any number of reasons for doing so other than communicating the way things really are. One may tell the truth in order to inform and educate or to correct a traditional error and set things right. But one's motives for telling the truth need not always be laudable. Whatever these motivations may be, they are necessarily secondary to the desire for communicating the way things really are. Establishing what is true is the primary goal. Without having accomplished that, the truth teller cannot succeed in accomplishing his other goals. Thus, the truth teller's primary motivation connects him with a concern with truth. The liar's primary motivation also connects him with a concern with truth. Noah Webster provides the following definition for the word liar: a person who knowingly utters falsehood, one who declares to another a fact that he knows to be not true, and with the intention to deceive him. This gives us a more complete definition of lying in that it includes the intention to deceive. The liar knows the truth and intends to deceive others by replacing it with a lie. Thus, the person who believes he speaks the truth while speaking a falsehood is not a liar because he lacks the intention to deceive. Conversely, the person who speaks the truth, which he erroneously believes to be a lie, is in fact a liar because he intends to deceive. The liar, too, may have many motivations for lying, concomitant to that of his intent to deceive. By deceiving, he may hope to gain some advantage, to avoid punishment, to do harm to another. But one's motives for lying need not always be blameworthy. Nevertheless, these are the reasons why one might lie, and not the structures necessary for defining what a lie is. It is conceivable that one need no other motive to lie but the intention to deceive, as with the pathological liar. Therefore, this motive is foundational to lying. Other motives must be considered as secondary, since the goal of deception must be fulfilled before any ancillary goal can be achieved. Though dedicated to an opposite goal, like the truth teller, the liar's primary motivation also connects him to a concern with truth. The kidder's primary motivation is usually to elicit in his audience either an external response or an internal response, or both. The kidder may hope to provoke in his audience a desired behavior. The kidder may wish to convince his audience to adopt a belief that about the kidder himself. He may or may not be telling the truth. He may or may not know the truth. But the kidder is in no way purposefully connected to a concern with truth. For his purposes, truth is irrelevant. While preparing this presentation, there were occasions in which I explained my topic to others. I found it interesting that the faith-promoting stories of Paul H. Dunn were, without exception, the first thing they called to mind. Paul Dunn, however, is a problematic example of kidding in Mormon culture. Although he often employed hyperbole or conflated two or more incidents, techniques often employed by the kidder, Paul Dunn intentionally and repeatedly lied about important episodes in his personal history that figure prominently in his stories. A clearer example of kidding in Mormon culture may be found in Bruce R. McConkie's non-explanation of the Adam-God doctrine. In his book, Mormon Doctrine, McConkie accuses those of believing this doctrine of being ignorant of the great principles of exaltation and unfriendly to the cause of righteousness. In his 1980 speech, The Seven Deadly Heresies, he alleges that the devil keeps this heresy alive as a means of obtaining converts to cultism. He uses the term cultism here as a deprecatory reference to Mormon fundamentalism. What makes these comments a form of kidding is the intent behind them, the expectation McConkie has of his audience. I have stated that often the kidder's primary motivation is to elicit in his audience either an external response or an internal response or both. For example, a call to some sort of action is commonly the purpose behind the efforts of professional kidders involved in marketing, politics, and public relations. Buy this product, vote for that candidate. Aware that actions are often triggered by beliefs, such professionals also design their kidding to affect the audience's thoughts and feelings. Admire this pop icon, despise that group. Now, McConkie makes only a limited explanation of Adam God. He does not explain the origins and development of the doctrine. He does not analyze the doctrine and explain why it is in error. He does not attempt to synthesize a solution to the difficulties it raises for 20th century Mormon thought. In fact, he barely discusses the doctrine at all. He discusses instead those who believe the doctrine, attacking them as either ignorant or wicked. His comments also convey the subtle imputation of shame upon those who would ask about this doctrine, for even to speak of it helps the devil keep this heresy alive. Now, it may or may not be true that one who believes this doctrine is ignorant or wicked. But McConkie's perfunctory dismissal of Adam God is not designed to demonstrate unequivocal proof of that fact. It is designed, rather, to turn away further inquiry, the external response, by making his audience feel vaguely guilty to have been curious about the subject, the internal response. What is most important here is that McConkie does not deny that Brigham Young and other apostles and presidents of the church believed this doctrine and taught it publicly and officially throughout most of the 19th century. This is important because had he denied it, his comments would have been an example of lying rather than of kidding. Inaction can also be a desired external response that one might hope to produce through kidding. In some political races, consultants will advise candidates to avoid addressing substantive issues that might galvanize the public into turning out to vote. This type of kidding involves the technique of misdirection, concentrating on one manageable truth with the hope that the audience will forget or ignore another less manageable truth. The LDS Church employs this type of kidding to a great advantage in their instructional manuals. Last year's Gospel Doctrine Manual on the Doctrine and Covenants in Church History actually covers little of the contents of the DNC and almost nothing of church history. The lesson on Section 132 offers no information as to the revelation's origin and guides the instructor to treat it as dealing exclusively with temple marriage. The manual advises the instructor to avoid discussing plural marriage, but provides a short explanatory paragraph to be read should someone raise the subject in class. Nowhere is there any mention of the topics of blood atonement or the second anointing. Almost without exception, adult Mormon pedagogy avoids questions of doctrine and history, sticking instead to a closed routine of lessons about moral values such as faith, honesty, obedience, charity, humility, and chastity, punctuated with pep talks about family home evening, home and visiting teaching, the word of wisdom, genealogy, and family preparedness. Thus we have it that thorny questions are, if not preempted, at least avoided. That these manuals are put together with great care and deliberation cannot be questioned. For the technique of misdirection to work most effectively, content must be purposefully selected, ordered, reviewed, reworked, and put forward. This misdirective kidding has been chosen for the manuals with a goal other than the communication of theological or historical truth. One could reasonably argue that the manuals are written with a concern for behavior over knowledge. Official church spokesmen will assert that the goal of the church manuals is to contribute to the spiritual edification of the saints. This is itself a species of kidding, for it is neither true nor false. But if church leadership were free to be completely candid, we might hear something more like this. Church leader, you want answers. Board member, I think I'm entitled. Church leader, you want answers. Board member, I want the truth. Church leader, you can't handle the truth. This may in fact be a valid argument. Perhaps church leaders feel an obligation to protect the optimistic theological ideal of ordered progress by ignoring the messy reality of things as they really are. Perhaps ignorance is bliss. One of the major sources of kidding is public opinion. As Americans, we feel compelled to own an opinion on almost everything, regardless of how far removed the topic is from our own personal experience or study. Political philosophy, world history, free market economics, current events, music, art and letters, it doesn't matter. We reserve the democratic right to make shamelessly ignorant pronouncements on any subject whatsoever, only exercising a modicum of care when we sense the risk of being called out by someone we're pretty sure knows more about it than we do. As an example of this, can be found in my use of St. Thomas Aquinas to help me define lying. The quote is accurate, but that was not of primary interest to me. I was more concerned with giving you the impression that I am learned enough to have read Aquinas. In this instance, the kidding is a product of a personal desire to seem smarter than I really am. This type of kidding abounds in Mormon publishing, where any four-year seminary graduate can get his gospel musings into print. The LDS Gospel of Light, in the LDS Gospel of Light, Grant Bishop, a dentist, confidently holds forth on the nature of God, time, space, and quantum mechanics. In Written by the Finger of God, Moonbeam Joe Sampson asserts that the Book of Mormon holds a secret meaning, which can only be unlocked with the Kabbalistic keys of the Tree of the Sephirot and the Kirtland Egyptian alphabet and grammar. My personal favorite is Straightforward Answers to Tough Gospel Questions by Joseph Fielding McConkie. All three books have sold very well in LDS bookstores. Esoteric kidding, like that of Joe Sampson, appears to have become quite popular among the Mormons. In the past few years, Deseret Book has published at least 9 titles dedicated to religious symbolism. In its last offering, The Lost Language of Symbolism, Alonso Gaskill explains the meaning of the number 9 as follows. 9 is the number of finality or judgment. It marks the completeness, the end and issue of all things as to man, the judgment of man and all his works. It is a factor of 666, which is 9 times 74. The gematria of Dan, the word Dan, which means judge, is 64, 9 times 6. The sieges of Jerusalem have been 27 in number, or 3 times 9, and they are stamped with the number of divine completeness, or divine involvement, the number 3, with the number of judgment, the number 9. Now, whatever the wow factor achieved by this numerical toss salad, In the end, it carries no real meaning. Randomly coincidental numerical correspondences have no real meaning in Mormon theology. This is intricately crafted kidding that leaves the reader with a great admiration for the erudition of the author and with the illusion of substance. Ironically, this particular definition of the number 9 is not original to the author, but rather a quote from a non-Mormon writer of Bible study guides. It is often the case that this kind of esoterica originates outside the Mormon tradition, but is presented to Mormons as if it originated within. While on the subject of esoterica, I must express my personal surprise that both Sunstone and Farms, as well as the official church website, have invested both time and bright minds to addressing and or exploring issues raised by the Da Vinci Code, a work of popular fiction inspired by a 20th century Gallic hoax. Who is kidding who? It is not my contention that as a group, Mormons compete over who can sound the most recondite. I believe that the propensity for wanting to appear brighter or more conversant than others is personal and not cultural. More often than not, we Mormons venture out of our depth. When we venture out of our depth, it is because our culture impels us to speak extensively about matters of which we know almost nothing. Everyone must speak in sacrament meeting. Everyone must teach a class. And those of us who attend the classes, it is expected that everyone participate. Through this, we prove we belong. Through this, we build trust and community. But for better or for worse, almost no one knows what he's talking about. This year's course of study in the Gospel Doctrine class is the Old Testament. In 999 out of 1,000 Gospel Doctrine classrooms, not one single person, including the class instructor, has read, let alone studied, the Old Testament. In such an environment, kidding is unavoidable. It can be reasonably argued that most of the kidding one finds in Mormon culture is harmless. Although not an unconscious act, I do believe we are not fully aware of how much kidding we are really involved in the church. Were we to become aware of this, and if with that realization we resolved to speak only of what we knew to be true, we might be surprised to find our Sunday meetings resembling those of the Quakers. The last incidence of kidding I wish to address is one I do not consider harmless. I refer to certain incautious counseling between bishops and ward members insofar as it involves matters beyond concerns of personal worthiness. A bishop has two jobs. He is the president of the Aaronic priesthood and a judge in Israel. The former qualifies him to receive revelation concerning ward members as it pertains to the administration and management of the ward's Aaronic priesthood functions. The latter qualifies him to receive revelation pertaining to the individual temple worthiness of each member of his ward. Unfortunately, many members expect much more from their bishop than he is qualified to give. They demand he be a marriage and family counselor, a career counselor, a financial advisor, a mediator, even a fashion consultant. The wise bishop will avoid answering the members' questions when they take him beyond the scope of his calling, steering them instead toward those who might have the requisite experience and knowledge. A brave bishop might offer secular advice to a member in need, but always with the clear disclaimer that his advice comes from his own considered opinion and not from the promptings of the Spirit. A careless bishop will confidently believe himself possessed of the Holy Spirit in counseling the members of his ward regarding all areas of their lives. This is ecclesiastical kidding. Section 121 of the Doctrine and Covenants warns us of this behavior among our leaders. We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion. Ecclesiastical kidding is a form of unrighteous dominion. Sadly, this passage warns us that it is in the nature of almost all men in authority to exercise unrighteous dominion. It does not say some leaders. It does not say many leaders. It says, almost all shepherds are guilty of kidding the flock at one time or another during their watch. This kidding may be well-intentioned and sincere, but it is kidding nonetheless. I am not suggesting that church leaders cannot receive spiritual inspiration for individual members relating to problems that fall outside the purview of the leader's ecclesiastic calling. But spiritual inspiration is to be had by both the leader and the member. In section 50 of the Doctrine and Covenants, we read the following. Therefore, why is it that ye cannot understand and know that he that receiveth the word of this by the Spirit of truth receiveth it as it is preached by the Spirit of truth? Wherefore, he that preacheth it and he that receiveth it understand one another, and both are edified and rejoice together. Rank and file members should expect to receive the same spiritual inspiration as that felt by the bishop, and not just blindly follow his direction in matters beyond the scope of his calling as president of the Aaronic priesthood and judge in Israel. Members who adopt the belief that their leaders are guided by the Spirit in all things, and that their opinions are unalloyed by personal assumptions as to the way things really are, do so out of spiritual laziness. They are shifting to someone else the responsibility for the important decisions they should be making in their own lives. I have not applied Frankfurt's theory of kidding to Mormon culture today with the idea that he has built a perspicuous and comprehensive theoretical structure. I am aware that his small treatise is written with an ironic tone of voice. But, be that as it may, Frankfurt does address the gray area between truth and lie, and it is this area I too often find unacknowledged within Mormon culture. Members who stumble over the kidding among us often can become disaffected and angry. Without an understanding of the complex nature of the cultural kidding and their own complicity in it. They often come to the simple conclusion that they have been lied to. Faithful members can react defensively to the accusations of deception because they are unconscious as to the reality of cultural kidding that swirls about them, influencing their behavior and infusing their beliefs with an unfortunate rigidity. The recognition of kidding within and without should chasten us. Resolving to call it when we see it as gently as possible can strengthen us within and without. My presentation is not without its weaknesses. Predominant among them is the unstated suggestion that we can know the intention behind something that someone says, that we can know unequivocally whether someone does or does not know the truth. Even with disciplined study and careful reasoning, we can only guess at someone's intentions, albeit an educated guess. To believe otherwise is simply bullshit.
Well, mine's definitely not going to be nearly as colorful as that was. But anyway, since Gordon B. Hinckley took over as president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, he has committed himself to multiple media interviews. Many of us were excited about such exposure. Many of us church members believe that our beliefs are greatly misunderstood. The Hinckley interviews was a chance for the truth to be unveiled. But to many of us, this hope did not come to pass. Hinckley was a little less than forthcoming when asked certain questions. Hinckley equivocated when asked questions about Mormon doctrines about God. In 1997, Hinckley was interviewed by Don Lanton of the San Francisco Chronicle. According to Lanton's article, he asked Hinckley about the Mormon doctrine that God was once a man. Quote, "There are some significant differences in your beliefs. For instance, don't Mormons believe that God was once a man?" Hinckley's answer, "I wouldn't say that. There was a little couplet coined, as man is, God once was, as God is, man may become. Now that's more of a couplet than anything else. That gets into some pretty deep theology that we don't know very much about." Next question, so you're saying the church is still struggling to understand this? Answer, "Well, as God is, man may become, we believe in eternal progression very strongly." In another interview with Richard Osling that was printed in Time magazine, Hinckley was asked a similar question. In this interview, Hinckley also seemed hesitant to answer questions about whether or not humans can become gods. Quote, "In an interview with Time, President Hinckley seemed intent on downplaying his faith's distinctiveness. At first, Hinckley seemed to qualify the idea that men could become gods, suggesting that it's of course an ideal, it's a hope for wishful thinking. But later affirmed that yes, of course they can. On whether his church still holds that God the Father was once a man, he sounded uncertain. I don't know that we teach it. I don't know that we emphasize it. I understand the philosophical background behind it, but I don't know a lot about it. And I don't think others know a lot about it. The concept that God was once a man is a very central doctrine of Mormonism that has been taught very consistently since Joseph Smith's King Follett Discourse in 1844. In modern times, it has rarely been mentioned in general conference, although Spencer W. Kimball did mention this in the priesthood session in April 1977. This doctrine is also taught in books published by the Church, such as the Gospel Principles Manual and the Institute Student Manuals, Doctrines of the Gospel and Church History in the Fullness of Times. Gordon B. Hinckley himself referred to God as being exalted in a pamphlet entitled What of the Mormons in 1982. Then in 1996, Hinckley taught at the Salt Lake Valley Wide Institute Fireside that the whole design of the gospel is to lead us onward and upward to greater achievement, even eventually to godhood. This great possibility was enunciated by the prophet Joseph Smith in the King Follett sermon and emphasized by President Lorenzo Snow. It is this grand and incomparable concept, as God now is, man may become. On September 8, 1998, Hinckley was interviewed by Larry King on the Larry King Live show on CNN. Hinckley gave what seemed to be a deceptive answer when asked about polygamy. King asked, "First tell me about the church and polygamy, when it started." Hinckley's answer, "When our people came west, they permitted it on a restricted scale." Hinckley's answer is technically true. Nauvoo, Illinois is west of where the church began in New York. However, we all know this answer is misleading, because when most people think of the Mormons coming west, they think of when the church left Nauvoo for Utah, and I'm sure Hinckley knows that. So what is going on? Is Hinckley being deceptive? Does Hinckley consider what he is doing as deceptive? I highly doubt he thinks that it's a form of deception, but rather using a religious principle that justifies not telling the truth or the whole truth as a way in which to protect his faith and church from ridicule. Although Mormonism and the Judeo-Christian tradition certainly have always had such a principle, which I'll discuss a little later, they do not have a name for this aid to faith. There is, however, one religious tradition in existence that does have a name for justified deception, and that is Islam, particularly Shiite Islam. The name is Al-Taqiyya, or just Taqiyya, and sometimes Ketman. In the world of Islam, Taqiyya is greatly debated. Many Shiites claim it is a principle that has always existed in Islam, while some Sunnis claim that it is a Shiite invention and not part of true Islam. I will not be addressing these debates of whether or not it's a Shiite concept or a Sunni concept. I'll let them debate that issue. But there are also debates over the different definitions of Taqiyya as far as the circumstances deception is justified. I have selected a few different definitions of this principle. The Wikipedia gives this definition. In the Shia Islamic tradition, taqiyya is the dissimulation of one's religious beliefs when one fears for one's life, the lives of one's family members, or for the preservation of faith. It is the most often used in times of persecution or danger. This source gives the rules of when taqiyya is allowed. Taqiyya, like any other Islamic tenet, has guidelines and limits. According to many Shia, taqiyya can only be legally used by a Muslim verbally when he or she is being wrongly persecuted. The situation may be when, no matter whichever course of action the individual chooses, he has to commit an evil. In that case, he should select the lesser evil. When one is guilty and is trying to conceal his or her guilt in Islam, this is not considered taqiyya. The Shiites use the Quran as justification for this principle. Quote, "Anyone after accepting faith in Allah utters unbelief except under compulsion, his heart remaining firm in faith, but such as open their breasts to unbelief. On them is wrath from Allah, and theirs will be a dreadful penalty." And that's Surah 16, 106. YPA also gives some of the history of tequila. In the year 612, the first use of tequila historically during the time of Muhammad, when Muslims were beginning to be tortured by the Qurayshites. Omar Yasir, a follower of Muhammad, whose friends had been killed for being Muslims by Quraysh, was confronted by a Qurayshite. Omar pretended to renounce Islam and thus saved his life. According to the hadith, the Prophet Muhammad later gave his permission for him to repeat such an act if he was placed again in danger. Most Sunnis criticize Omar for his actions or questions the reliability of the story. Sunnis cite the examples of many Muslims who were tortured and murdered merely based on their beliefs during the time of Muhammad, but didn't renounce their faith. Most Sunnis believe that God decides when someone is going to die, and therefore it is wrong to deny the faith in order to escape torture or death. In 618, quotes, Sa'id Zayd and Fatima bint al-Khattab were married and both hid their faith from Umar ibn al-Khattab to be safe. And more recently in 2003, quote, critics of the Argentine president Carlos Saul Menem of Syrian descent have dismissed his early conversion to Christianity as tequila, close quote. Most definitions use these instances from Islamic history, but add some different justifications for the use of the principle. Another definition says this, quote, the word al-taqiyya literally means concealing or disguising one's beliefs, convictions, ideas, feelings, opinions, and or strategies at a time of imminent danger, whether now or later in time, to save oneself from physical and mental injury. A one-word translation would be dissimulation. Other commentators of this principle extend it to a Muslim being able to break Islamic dietary rules when their life is in danger from starving. Ibn Shihad gives three instances where lying is justified. In battle for bringing reconciliation amongst persons, and the narration of the words of the husband to wife, and the narration of words of a husband to her, words of a wife to her husband in a twisted form in order to bring reconciliation between them. Other definitions extend this to diplomacy, to get along with people, and also to manifest friendship or enmity. Another writer has written that the literal meaning of tequila is to safeguard, to defend, to fear, piety, because it saves one from the displeasure of Allah. The definitions concerning definition to safeguard faith, save lives, using diplomacy to get along with others, and to promote peace and friendship is what I believe has existed in Mormonism since the beginning. Joseph Smith's revelations introduce a principle similar to tequila almost at the beginning. In the Book of Mormon, in order to receive the plates of brass, Nephi dressed in Laban's clothes in order to deceive Zoram. Then in March 1830, Joseph Smith received this revelation concerning hell. Quote, nevertheless, it is not written that there shall be no end to this torment, but it is written endless torment. Again, it is written eternal damnation, wherefore it is more expressed in other scriptures that it might work upon the hearts of the children of men altogether for my name's glory. This verse implies that God used the phrase endless torment in order to work on the hearts of the children of men, even though the torment is not actually endless. In Joseph's Book of Abraham, it is God who tells Abraham to tell the Egyptians that his wife Sarah is his sister. The principle of tequila really took hold in Mormonism in the 1840s in regard to polygamy. Joseph Smith wrote to Nancy Rigdon and said this in 1842, quote, that which is wrong under one circumstance may and often is right under another. God said, thou shalt not kill. At another time he said, thou shalt utterly destroy. This is the principle on which the government of heaven is conducted, by revelation adapted to the circumstances in which the children of the kingdom are placed. Whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is, although we may not see the reason thereof till long after the events transpire. Close quote. This statement is not far off from how many Muslims interpret the principle of tequila. Michael Quinn has demonstrated in his essay, LDS Church Authority and New Plural Marriages, that Joseph Smith, Hiram Smith, Wilford Woodruff, John Taylor, and Polly P. Pratt, among others, denied the existence of polygamy being practiced in the church, even though all knew that it was being practiced and many were doing it themselves at the time. To admit the practice of polygamy could have put Joseph and others in imminent danger. According to the principle of Thakia, a person is justified in lying if their life or the lives of others is in danger. In 1881, Apostle Abraham H. Cannon wrote a similar idea in his diary that it is good to always tell the truth, but not always tell the whole of what we know. In the award-winning biography of Emma Smith, Mormon Enigma, Linda King Newell and Valene Tippetts Avery demonstrate that Joseph Smith was a little less than honest with Emma in regard to polygamy. Assuming that Joseph really believed himself to have been commanded to practice plural marriage, Smith was faced with a dilemma. Joseph could either disobey God and make Emma happy, or obey God and keep it from Emma to promote peace in his marriage. According to certain definitions of Thakia, when one is faced with two evil options, a person is to choose the lesser of the two evils. This concept may have influenced Joseph to make the decision that he made. The principle of Thakia, of course, was used yet again when the decision was made to end polygamy. Many leaders felt they were faced with the dilemma of obeying the government or obeying God. What some felt was the lesser of two evils was once again chosen. Richard Van Wagner writes that President Joseph F. Smith continued the familiar pattern established in Nauvoo of publicly denying what was being privately practiced. I'm going to have to skip a little here because I'm going to run out of time. But I just want to say Joseph Fielding Smith is what I call a Thakia master. In his some of his publications and in his 1905 letter exchange with Richard Evans, he totally misused a source that I believe he knew he was misusing to argue that Joseph Smith started polygamy. Most of you probably already know that, but anyway, so I gotta skip that. As evidenced. Many other instances of Mormonism's use of Thakia could be cited. Juanita Brooks believes that John D. Lee was sacrificed by the church leaders for the crime of the Mount Meigs massacre in order to save the church. As evidenced by Gordon B. Hinckley, Thakia is alive and well in today's church. In General Conference on October 4, 1997, Hinckley said this concerning these media interviews. Quote, the media have been kind and generous to us. There have been a few things we wish might have been different. I personally have been much quoted, and a few instances misquoted and misunderstood. None of you need worry because you read something that was incompletely reported. You need not worry that I do not understand some matters of doctrine. I think I understand them thoroughly, and it is unfortunate that the reporting may not make this clear. I hope you will never look at the public press as the authority on church, on doctrines of the church. The statement is very, close quote. The statement is very puzzling. Hinckley never identifies what was misquoted. All he says is that he knows the doctrines of the church well and tells members to not look to the media for church doctrine. What does he mean by this? I speculate that he may be implying that since he won't be totally straightforward with the media, don't listen to what he says is for church doctrine. Almost, maybe it's an admission, I don't know. Another recent example of Thakian Mormonism is Boyd K. Packer's speech to church educators in 1981, in which he said, quote, there's a temptation to want to tell everything, whether it is worthy or faith-promoting or not. Some things that are true are not very useful. In an effort to be objective, impartial, and scholarly, a writer or a teacher may unwittingly be giving equal time to the adversary. In the church, we are not neutral. Close quote. So according to Packer, telling the truth can sometimes give power to Satan. Anyone who has read Leonard Erring's book knows of some of the trials he had with certain church leaders on writing church history. I won't mention too much about that. I also believe missionaries tend to use this principle of Thakia. When I was on my mission, whenever you're asked by a investigator at the very beginning whether or not Mormons believe you can become gods, so kind of the standard answer, it's not a lie, but kind of de-emphasize it, was, we believe that humans can become like God. Right? No one would ever say, absolutely. In 1844, Joseph Smith taught that we need to learn to be gods ourselves. Although I do not have time to cite some specific examples, I also believe that Mormon apologists make great use of Thakia, as do Christian apologists also. It should be remembered that the principles of justified deception, such as the Qiyas, certainly do not exist only in Islam and Mormonism. Whether we like to admit it or not, it has been a part of the Judeo-Christian tradition for hundreds and even thousands of years. In Sunstone magazine in March 2005, in speaking about Joseph Smith being a pious deceiver, Dan Vogel wrote, quote, "Why is it impossible to believe that a prophet would engage in deception? It's certainly not without biblical precedent. Abraham and Isaac both lied about the marital status of their wives. Abraham lied to Isaac about the true object of the sacrifice they were preparing. Jacob deceived Isaac to obtain the firstborn's blessing owed to Esau. Moses lied to Pharaoh. One prophet lied to another in 1 Kings 13, and Jehu pretended to worship Baal." In the Gospel of John, it appears, and I won't read it because I'm running out of time here, but some of the answers Jesus gives to Pontius Pilate in the Gospel of John are less than straightforward. He kind of weaves himself around them, much the way Hinckley did. And also you have the book of Judith, where God himself assisted Judith in telling a lie. Now to conclude, by answering whether or not a principle like Taqiyya should exist as an aid to faith. Many of the instances I have cited where Mormonism has engaged in deception do trouble me, although I understand the reasoning behind most of them. I am also one that refrains from making value judgments. However, before anyone passes harsh judgment on Mormonism or other religions that engage in justified deception, I would ask that you consider the fact that concepts such as Taqiyya are certainly not limited to religion. Society in general has such a principle. One definition of Taqiyya say that lying is justified to bring reconciliation between husband and wife. Most of us would tell our wives they look pretty in their new dress, whether we thought it or not. Most of us would tell our husbands or wives what a nice dinner they made, even if we threw up afterwards. When an overweight person admits to the fact that they're overweight, most of us will give them comforting words, even if we agree to the fact that they're obese. Many of us are untruthful or simply silent about our religious or political views when around members of our family who hold different views in order to promote peace and love. And who hasn't called in sick to work when they weren't really sick? How many parents have deceived their young children into thinking some big fat guy dressed up in a red suit comes down their chimney on the night of December 24th to bring presents? If you have an appointment with a doctor because of a bad case of hemorrhoids, how honest would you be with your neighbor or anyone else why you needed to see the doctor? Can anyone truly condemn someone for not denying their faith when their life is in danger? Can we truly condemn anybody that deceived the Nazis in hiding the Jews? Many more examples could be cited of how many of us justify deception. But just remember, before passing judgment on anyone else for engaging in deception, you should take a hard look at yourself. I would promote this, however, that the Mormons and church leaders admit that there is a principle such like Taqiyya in Mormonism, and to also give it a name so that I can look it up in future church publications or a future Mormon doctrine book. Certainly, everyone has a different definition of when deception is justified. An agreement could never be reached, just like it never has in the Islamic world in regards to Taqiyya, but I would like to at least see an acknowledgement that it exists, at least in some form, in Mormonism. Thank you.
All right, questions, comments? Line on up at the microphone.
A question for Scott. You mentioned when Joseph Smith was, excuse me, when Hinckley was asked about the relationship between God and man, he started out saying, "Well, I don't know we ever taught that," which is obvious bullshit. But then he went on to say, "I'm not sure we know very much about it." Is it possible that he inadvertently told the truth without really intending to?
To have said that we don't know very much about the doctrine of exaltation is probably closer to the truth than it is to BS. I mean, if you want, I'm sure he could argue that, okay, what there is that we don't know far exceeds what we do know, therefore I have to say we don't know very much about it.
concerning back in Joseph Smith's time of his various versions of his first vision, and the one that the church has chosen now to use for proselyting and teaching in junior Sunday school, do you consider that as being a lie or bullshit?
I don't know that I would call that a lie or bullshit. It's kind of just traditionally come down as the traditional story, and that's what we use. I mean, obviously, you don't hear much in church about the differences between them, but certainly it's been the 1832 account and all that's been published in the personal writings of Joseph Smith, so it's not like they're the church, which is by Deseret Book, so it's not like they're covering it up. But I don't know if that answers your question, but I mean, that's my thought.
I would agree with Ryan. I don't think that there's been any, I think that you're looking at a situation, well, I guess I should say that I've accepted the collective wisdom on this, that different stories at different times for different audiences, different things were recalled or forgotten given the circumstances. I've never seen any attempt by the church to hide the fact that there are multiple first vision accounts. In fact, I recall a treatment of the various accounts done in the Ensign.
In the church's latest Joseph Smith movie and other church media presentations of Joseph Smith, you see a different version of Joseph Smith that's usually then portrayed in scholarly works and whatnot. So I wanted to your comments on whether or not you thought of these church presentations as being lying or bullshit, and also comment on the relationship between a devotional work and a scholarly work, and that relationship to lying and bullshit.
The latest film that I've seen is bullshit. This is, if Joseph watched the film, he would have to repress the urge to repeat that word. This is obviously a 21st century idealization of a rough and ready 19th century man that we're not very comfortable with anymore. I find the same thing occurs, for example, in the Relief Society and priesthood manuals, the teachings of the president. They're always introduced with a brief biography, and it's interesting that for each president who did practice plural marriage, it says nothing about that at all. I noticed, for example, I didn't have time to go into those quotes. I knew I wouldn't have time, so I didn't include them, but I can remember getting that very first manual, 1978, the Brigham Young manual, and looking up the quotes that they quoted and realizing, oh my heck, Brigham's talking about something completely different than what is than what this nice little chopped up little piece of quote is really communicating. So the editors of the manual, say here's a quote on Brigham Young on tithing, then you go to the larger quote and you realize he's saying if you don't pay your tithing, we'll slit your throats from ear to ear. And I'm kidding, he doesn't really say that, but that was a little bit of bullshit, but. But the question of devotional, devotional moments and whether they need to be historically or not historically, but whether they have to be a representative of the way things really are. I think that there are devotional moments when maybe words escape us. We can't fully define what it is that we feel or what it is that we've experienced, and it may lead to moments of exaggeration or attribution. An example of this, I know of an instance where a woman bore her testimony during Fast and Testimony meeting, and Please don't think that this was going on in my mind as this sweet woman was giving her testimony. I'm not really that critical of people, but she was talking about how what a miracle she had experienced in going to Brazil to pick up her son, that they were told by the mission president that, you know, that the souvenirs they had bought would never make it through customs, and her son had been, you know, so excited about bringing these souvenirs home, and they knelt down and they prayed about it before they went through customs, and when they got to customs opened up the suitcase, looked at the souvenirs, zipped it back up, and they were on their way. And she began to weep as she told this story. Customs doesn't give a crap whether you're taking souvenirs out of the country. You know, I'm sorry, but they want American tourists to buy things and take them out of the country. They don't want that crap. Take it away at greatly inflated prices. And yet this woman somehow felt that, you know, felt obligated to act, to attribute the hand of God in at that very moment. I am a little, and I'm probably going to go over time here, one thing that I have noticed with kids growing up through the teen years, we do have in this church a real strange growth of faith-promoting activities, where we get our kids into a real emotional lather, and then we hold a fast and testimony meeting, and I'm really bothered by those. There was one instance where I was called to participate in it when they described the event to me, wherein the kids were to be made to feel as if, in fact, their lives were in danger, you know, and then their parents would appear in white as if their parents were dead, and I refused. I said, I won't participate, and I won't let my kids come to that thing. I don't think that, you know, winding the emotions of our children up are teaching them anything about the impressions of the Holy Spirit.
I'm just wondering either of your opinions. To what extent does bullshit or kidding go towards preserving the group? Like, for instance, things in the Sunday school manual that you mentioned that are, you know, certain, like, for instance, when you get to Doctrine and Covenant, section 132, if they're teaching that year, that we don't talk about polygamy or the way President Hinckley responds to the media, to what extent do the way that they respond or the manuals are organized, to what extent does that preserve the group, or do you think the church is afraid of, if you're bringing out the whole truth, may I don't know, damage group cohesion? What's your opinion on that?
I believe as an institution, the church won't touch on a lot of those subjects. Again, I think it's because we have an actual principle where to retain faith, you know, we don't want to talk about those things that might hurt someone. You know, Packer said some things that are true are not always helpful. But I want to kind of counter that by saying I don't think the church necessarily hides anything, because they do allow, well, okay, let me qualify that. In the sense that the church, I mean, they're allowing this Joseph Smith Papers project to go forward. You know, there's lots of controversial things I know are going to be published in that. So in that sense, they do allow some of the embarrassing things to come out. Certainly, some of you grimaced when I said they don't hide anything. Certainly, they do hide. Well, they don't allow all documents to be seen in the church archives, but that wasn't really the question, so I won't go too much into that.
Got a new word that explains kind of the last 15 years of my life. Takiya. Duh. What about when the whole ward decides on something without consulting you about who you are, and then they don't speak to you for 13, 15 years? Is that takiya? I mean, am I dangerous or something? I mean, they won't to this day address their shunning. throughout Relief Society?
Certainly,
everywhere?
Certainly. There's no formula for the, a fine. There's no fine line between out and out lying and taqiyya in the world of Islam. I would say, however, that from the definitions that I've read, that probably isn't taqiyya. From what I've
seen.
Well,
would you say it is then? Because to this day, I can't. You know, one bishop said nobody likes you, so you can't get any counseling here.
Well, that,
and
that,
so
that's...
after that, the Relief Society dropped me, and then everybody agreed that I was to be fellowshipped, but not included.
Well, that's called meanness more than anything. Right?
Thank you. Okay, that's good.
Thank you for coming. Our time's up.